York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles. I still
remember. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knowles. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin by the latest on health and healing, all from good quality sources. And I always try to select the information you have not heard or would not receive by the mainstream media that first filters the information, make sure it's not offending any pharmaceutical company or special interest group. We give it to you, and hopefully you'll use it and have a longer life. We're also going to do something on the environment today. I'm going to do a quick update going around the world, just showing you the different environmental issues that are important, and even if we're not aware of it, or if it's not getting attention. Also today, I will address part two of what I started on our last program, and that was to to discuss the history of our founding fathers in a way that we may better understand why they created the laws they did, what their beliefs were. Now, these were not perfect people by any means. Even some that are considered highly intelligent, like Thomas Jefferson, they had some substantial flaws. So we're going to put all this in perspective, but I'm interested in the progenitor. Where something originated? How did they come up with their ideas? Because much of the language of the Declaration of Independence, I can show, was written by others earlier in Europe, in the Age of Reason. But then the Renaissance was inspiring many of the movements, both architectural movements, but also literary movements and scientific movements that led to the Age of Reason. So we're going to take you back and give you a little longer history lesson so you see where everything came from. Also today, at about 12:30, I'm going to be having, I don't know how many, hopefully five or six individuals who completed a one-month retreat. And each had a condition that was considered medically irreversible. And I'd like to see what their status is. I have not spoken with any of them. You'll be hearing as I hear, a month later, how they're doing. We always like to do follow-ups to see, did something work for people? Not just then, but were they able to take it home and sustain it? And hopefully we'll get all this in this hour. So let's begin. Anyone who has watched a puppy play and run up and grab your shoelace and run through the house with a slipper in their mouth, or they just love attention, they love to play, and you can't help but smile when you see them. The same is true for kittens. Well, at a university, Uppsala University, they found that dog ownership is linked to living a longer life. A team of Swedish scientists have used the national registries of more than 3.4 million Swedes, 40 to 80, in their study, who own a dog. And then they compared that with cardiovascular disease. And they did this study, and then they did a 12-year follow-up, and they found that dog owners have a lower risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. So that's important. And a quote, this is from the study. A very interesting finding in our study was that dog ownership was especially prominent as a protective factor in persons living alone, which is a group reported previously to be a higher risk of cardiovascular disease and death than those living in multi-person households. Perhaps a dog may stand in as an important family member in the single household. So owning a dog, especially if you're single, well, that required 33% reduction in death and 11% reduction in risk of cardiovascular disease during that 12-year period. I think that's terrific. And if you have a dog or have a cat, then you know how important they are. And they become a part of your family. And they're there nonstop, at least dogs, all the time to love you. And in this world where today, and in particular, so many people who are in middle-aged or older are living alone, and they're sad. Maybe they've had good relationships or friendships, but now that is gone. And there's that kind of emptiness of, boy, you know, when you're not busy, it'll come to mind. One of the people that you, or many of the people that you had in your life, and the joy you had, the fun you had, the excitement. And now you think, gee whiz, can that ever happen again? For most people, the answer is no. However, that's not no because it can happen. That's no because they're not putting themselves in a position to make it happen. Because we like to think of everything that we do, that we commit ourselves to, as being permanent. We rarely take our own health and life at a position where we look at it in stage. We just don't think it's going to happen. Our friendship's the same way. Even our health. I can't tell you how many people I met at a high school reunion who are really out of shape, and they look far older than their chronological age, and yet they were athletic in high school or in college. And they'll tell you, well, I don't know how it happened. I just stopped doing this intensive exercise, and, you know, I put on the weight, and now they've got all these health problems. So having a pet gets you outside. You can go outside and run with them. So if you're lonely and if you are susceptible to heart disease, then a dog can make a difference. From the University of Sydney comes a study about something I mentioned a couple weeks ago. Remember, I said that before you have an intentional pregnancy, take a year to a year and a half to detoxify and rejuvenate your cells so that your DNA is going to be as healthy as possible. Then even take the time to look back into your immediate ancestry to see, was there anything going on in our parents and grandparents that could contribute to a negative epigenetic outcome, meaning something that they weren't dealing with in life or dealing with it inappropriately that's in their DNA. The memory is passed on. And you can, in effect, change that programming once you're conscious of it. We can't change what we don't know exists. It continues to exist in us. But you can change it if you know, well, my grandmother was a person who had a raging temper, and she didn't speak with people, she yelled at people. Let's just say that that was a grandparent, hypothetically. Well, that DNA is now in all the other offspring. It doesn't mean that you will manifest it, but it means it's there and can be triggered. So by going back through, and the best way of going back through your background is through regressive hypnosis, because there your conscious mind is suspended, and you go into your deeper mind of actual events, and then you can see the impact and what's actually there, and then through good humanistic psychoanalysis, you can reprogram it. There's even a process called rebirthing. And by the way, that rebirthing does work. I followed some people who were doing rebirthing, and I saw the benefits to their patients, and it was sustainable. Also, there is what's called tapping, and the person, Dr. Grayson, Henry Grayson, he's over on 57th Street, wonderful human being, by the way, one of the brightest people in America, by the way. And I believe he was former head of the American Psychological Association, or the Humanistic Psychological Association, one of them. But he created this way of getting the energy of the body to respond to a vibration and a sound that you make. Because everything is vibration, even the voice. My voice right now, a little hoarse because I've been counseling really all days for the last 2 days, helping terminally ill people, even though I'm at my ranch, not in the city. I still help as many times as I can in a day. I help the terminally ill by phone. And everything is in the vibration. Now, mind you, you're in synchronicity with my voice. Therefore, you can understand what I'm saying. But if you were born in China, you wouldn't understand what I'm saying. You may feel it, but you couldn't understand it. So developing a harmonizing awareness of different frequencies allows you to be in sync with it, no different than someone who goes into the woods can harmonize with the trees and the birds. Someone else can harmonize with the waves at a beach. Someone else would love the desert and the high country. Someone can harmonize with one type of music, another type of music. But it's all the same at this level. It is all coming from our chi, our vital life force, these vibrations. And the messages is in the vibration. It's just being able to decipher it. And at the core level, at the limbic level, there's no deciphering that's necessary. It's understood. There's a quantum association, a relationship. It's like, every mother in the world, I don't care what tribe, I don't care how remote they are, they're going to coo and cuddle and kiss their baby and hug them and breastfeed them. They weren't taught to do that necessarily. It's part of the hardwired instinct of association. Anyhow, so their parents should understand that before you have a child, realize that everything in your body will make the difference in there being an offspring that is healthy or one that starts life with disadvantages at the vibrational level, that there is no scientific means now to detect that. In fact, even if there's minimal brain damage, you won't know it. It'll only be years later when you see that the child is a little slow in the word uptake, a little slow in identification, response, and then you don't know what caused it. Could be epigenetic. Could be the fact that you had an unhealthy diet and didn't want to change. So we really should pay attention. Here's what the University of Sydney says. A review of studies about parents' diets and the immunity of animal offspring has found a close relationship exists with implications for wildlife conservation and livestock rearing as well as human health. The meta-analysis, meaning many different, showed that what goes into the diet of the human or animal directly impacts the offspring. So you can start life with a healthier immune response, even though there's technically you don't have the bacteria. Everything's coming from the mother. You don't realize that when a mother kisses the baby, she's picking up saliva from the kiss, and then her body automatically makes antibodies and goes right into the breast milk. So when the breast is used by the baby for feeding, it is bringing in the natural medicine of life, the functional foods. And breast milk, healthy breast milk, is the most perfect functional medicine for that child to keep them healthy and vibrant. So for all those parents that don't breastfeed, you should. And for those who are breastfeeding but themselves are toxic, they smoke, they drink, they eat garbage food, you're not doing your baby the service that it deserves. Also, I found this interesting. That's why I want to share it with you. This is from the University of British Columbia. And it's about the amount of close and comforting contact between infants and their caregivers that can affect children at the molecular level. Now, we know at the emotional level, yes, an effect detectable 4 years later, according to new research from the University of British Columbia and the British Columbia Children's Hospital Research Institute. The study showed that children who had been more distressed as infants and had received less physical contact had a molecular profile in their cells that was underdeveloped for their age, pointing to the possibility that they were lagging biologically. Quote, in children, we think slower epigenetic aging might indicate an inability to thrive. So, what is the implication of this? The implications are important because for childhood development and adult health, we have not fully understood the biology of it, but we know that the more attention a child's given, cuddling, you know, and hugging, holding hands, all the things that a child needs, the healthier their biology and the epigenetic blueprint of that is still present 4 years later. This was published in Development and Psychopathology. Also, a new study suggests that listening to happy music promotes more divergent thinking, a key element of creativity. Why? This was in the University of California. And it talks about in today's world, creative thinking is needed more than ever. Not only do many businesses seek creative minds to fill their ranks, but the kinds of complex and social problems that we talk about every day on this air and its solutions, we need a really big dose of creativity. Luckily, creativity is not reserved for artists and geniuses alone. Modern science suggests that we all have the cognitive capacity to come up with original ideas. Something researchers call divergent thinking. And we can all select from a series of ideas that one most likely is to be successful, which researchers call convergent thinking. So, to put this in lay language, though we may not all be equally accomplished at these kinds of thinking, we can all become more skillful in creative problem solving. Now, whether the problems we face involve figuring out technological challenges at work or the next steps to take in creating a new painting, the question is how. So, one new study explores music as a source of creativity. And since music has been shown to improve cognition and enhance learning and enhance memory, it makes sense that perhaps it has an impact on creative thinking also. So in the experiments, participants tried creativity exercises that measured divergent or convergent thinking while being exposed to either silence, which is a controlled scenario, or classical music that evoke four different emotions, such as happy, calm, sad, and anxious. And after comparing participant performance on divergent and convergent thinking in the five scenarios, the researchers found that participants who listened to happy music had significantly higher scores on divergent thinking than those who had performed in silence. In other words, they came up with more total ideas, more creative and innovative ideas. So that's something to do. Think about happy music and see if you can't have better ideas. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. And I especially want to say hello to all of our sister stations, those on carrying us on satellite and syndication, and just people listening over the internet around the world. I very much appreciate the fact that you share your ideas. Please continue to do so, your questions and your experiences. And you can always reach me by going to I'm going to ask my engineer to tell me which one it is that they could go to if they want to share ideas. I'll share that with you in a second. In any case, 41 years on WBAI, and that's the longest running non-commercial radio program in American history daily. So we want to thank all of you who've been on board for a long period of time, and some have been there longer. You can always listen in live if you're traveling and not able to get to a computer or a land-based station by just taking any portable listening device and calling this number. Let me give it to you. Listen live, Monday to Friday, noon to 1, 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. But if you're so busy and you can't listen live, you want to listen later at home, fine. Here's the number, 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. The other day, before we go to people who are standing by who attended the retreat, the other day, I wanted to give us a little history about the Founding Fathers, to put it into a more humanistic context. And I had mentioned that a lot of our Founding Fathers were Freemasons. Now, the average person, they don't know what a Freemason is. You mean a Shriner? What is a Freemason? Well, Freemasons did not view Jesus as traditional Christianity, and certainly not evangelical Christianity. Rather, Jesus was highly regarded as a man who attained the highest degree of moral enlightenment. So they were concerned about morality. Now, some would show great morality and others would not, though they considered themselves Masonry, but at least you understand the underlying principle. Now, we have some people who were all Masonic affiliations. They considered themselves Freemasons. And generally, it was the more educated philosophers and academics, professors. In fact, though John Adams spoke favorably of Freemasonry, he never joined. And there was Samuel Adams, Ethan Allen, Edwin Burke, John Claypool, William Dawes, Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock. We had Patrick Henry, I believe. Thomas Jefferson was supportive of the Masons, but he was a deist. And John Paul Jones, Robert Livingston. There was Thomas Paine was called a Freemason. He was a humanist, not a Mason. Paul Revere was a Mason, and Colonel Benjamin Tupper was a Mason. Joseph Warren was a Mason. George Washington was a Mason, and Daniel Webster. So we had a lot of Masons, a humanist, advocates for Freemasonry, who were signers of the Declaration of Independence. And they had a lot of important connections, like French General Lafayette was a Mason. And almost all of George Washington's generals were selected because they were Masons. In fact, George Washington was sworn as the first president of the United States by Robert Livingston. He was the Grand Master of New York's Masonic Lodge. And in fact, the Bible on which he took his oath was from his own Masonic Lodge. And throughout the Continental Army, you found Masonic Army Lodges for the troops and officers. And there was also a man named Joseph Warren. You may or may not have heard of him. In point of fact, he enrolled in Harvard. Talk about a bright guy. He was 14, and by the age of 22, he was the youngest doctor in Boston. And his patients were Samuel Adams and John Hancock, and two future presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. He was also a famous doctor for the British officers who he spied on, and he was responsible for the Suffolk Resolves boycott of British goods in Boston, responsible for dispatching Paul Revere on his midnight ride with 40 other people, I might mention. He was also responsible for ordering Benedict Arnold to attack a fort, and Warren served as a Grand Master of the St. Andrew's Lodge of Freemasons and presided over meetings at its headquarters inside the Green Dragon Tavern. And the lodge included many of the Sons of Liberty, such as Paul Revere. And the Boston Tea Party, which I'm sure everyone in this audience remembers, was planned at the Green Dragon Tavern, also known as the Freemasons' Arms, or the headquarters of the Revolution. And while other Sons of Liberty members, such as John Hancock and Samuel Adams and John Adams, convened in Philadelphia as delegates to the Continental Congress, Warren borrowed a musket to fight the British at the Battle of Bunker Hill on June 17, 1775. And although appointed a major general by the Massachusetts Provincial Congress just 3 days before, the 34-year-old, imagine achieving all that by 34, he was shot and he died. And but a lot of people who knew him said that if he had lived, he would have been president of the United States, not George Washington. And by the way, as I mentioned, you may have heard of Paul Revere, the Boston silversmith who actually accompanied as many as 40 other men on their midnight ride to sound the alarm that the British were coming. But 2 years later, 16-year-old Sybil Lundington, the daughter of a colonel, rode 40 miles on her own, alone, to warn the New York militia members that the British were burning down Danbury, Connecticut. And it was not the first major uprising, as some believe. In fact, by 1760, there had already been 18 major uprisings by colonists against foreign powers, 6 large black slave rebellions everywhere from New York to South Carolina, and 40 other riots. Hence, America had a rebellious spirit. And since they didn't have money for big navy, the Continental Congress hired pirates to attack British ships. They were then supposed to split the booty, bounty, I should say, with the U.S. And George Washington's teeth, we were all told they were made of wood. No, they were actually hippopotamus ivory and cow's teeth. They were held in place by metal springs. And you talk about being painful. That would have been painful. I mentioned that we had a lot of founding fathers who might have been very bright and brave, but they were also grossly flawed. Thomas Jefferson has to be at the top of the list because he owned slaves, and he did not believe that all were created equal. He was a racist. He was incapable of rising above the thought of his time and place, and willful to profit from slave labor. And Jefferson, like all slaveholders, many other white members of American society regarded Negroes at that time as inferior, childlike, and untrustworthy, and as personal property. And in his initial draft of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson condemned the injustices of slave trade and, by implication, slavery, but he also blamed the presence of enslaved Africans on British colonial policies. And Jefferson acknowledged that slavery violated the natural rights of the enslaved, but at the same identical time, talk about cognate dissonance, he absolved Americans of any responsibility for owning slaves themselves. And there were a lot of slaveholders who are founding fathers: Charles Carroll, Samuel Chase, Benjamin Franklin, Button Gwinnett, John Hancock, Patrick Henry, John Jay, Thomas Jefferson, Richard Henry Lee, James Madison, Charles Coatworthy Pinckney, Benjamin Rush, the signer of the Declaration of Independence, who was also the first chief psychiatrist. He was a complete sociopath. Edward Rutledge, George Washington. Washington did free his slaves. And of the 9 presidents who owned slaves, only Washington freed his. The other 8 kept them. But remember, we had people who were against slavery. John Adams, Samuel Adams, Oliver Ellsworth, Alexander Hamilton, George Mason, Robert Treat Paine, Thomas Paine, Roger Sherman. And a lot of people don't know this, but there were Muslims in the colonies, and Muslims fought in the Revolutionary War for America. The slave trade had approximately 12.5 million slaves were brought to the New World from Africa. And the majority went to Brazil and northern Latin American countries and the Caribbean. About 600,000 came to North America. And about 10 to 15% of those were Muslims. And Muslims' name appear on the soldier rosters of regiments and militias during the Revolutionary War, like Bampit Muhammad, a colonel who served in the Virginia attachments in 1775, and Yusuf Ali, who also served. In fact, you had campaigning for religious freedom in Virginia, and Jefferson argued in the proposed Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom that neither pagan nor what was called a Mohammedan, which meant Muslim, nor Jew ought to be excluded from the civil rights of the Commonwealth because of their religion. Unfortunately, this language was amended before the ratification to remove reference to non-Christian groups. And enslaved Muslims left numerous written accounts of their experience in America in the form of letters and diaries and autographs, most of it in Arabic. And they strategically used Arabic to communicate with one another to undermine slavery. You have some very famous ones at the time, Salih Beleli and Amin Kibi. But anyhow, when it came to Washington and women, he also was not supportive of women, well, needless to say. But just to put a fine point on it, Jefferson also threw up his hands about women's rights. Abigail Adams, at one time Jefferson's close friend, raised it. But Jefferson's attitude towards women was the same as other white men of his age. He wrote about almost everything, but almost never about women, nor about his wife, nor his mother, nor certainly not Sally Hennings. And also, most people are not aware of this, but disease, not bullets and bayonets or cannon fire, had been the greater killer of soldiers in all armies. In 1775, the smallpox epidemic had so devastated the American army in Canada that John Adams wrote that smallpox is 10 times more terrible than the British, Canadians, and Indians together. And Washington survived smallpox himself in 1751 and was familiar with how disease could rob the cause of his army. And so, and you also didn't have high-level ethical politics back then. In fact, the modern-day mudslinging is not new. They threw dirt back in the 1800 presidential elections between President John Adams and the sitting Vice President Thomas Jefferson. And while the Federalist Adams believed in a strong centralized government and the Republican Jefferson favored states' rights, the debate went before the public as personal attacks. And everything you could do to try to hurt another one, they did. They said that Adams was a hideous hermaphrodite, that he smuggled prostitutes into the country from England and planned to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George III to establish a royal bloodline in his family. All lies. So they were clear up to what people do today. And Washington had a very haughty idea of himself, and no one knew quite how to address him. So they were talking the weeks after his 1789 inauguration, that how do you address him? Well, Adams, who presided over the Senate as the first vice president, felt the office required a grand title to convey power on par with the royal courts of Europe. So he felt Washington should be called His Majesty the President, or His Highness the President of the United States, or the Protector of the Rights of the Same. Fortunately, none of that ended up happening. Now, I'm going to save my comments about Freemasonry and its history, and I also want to talk about the Renaissance and the Age of Reason, or what is known as the Enlightenment period, for tomorrow. But now we're going to go to our phone. We're standing by our, from what I'm told, six individuals, and who are here with Luann Vanessi. I have not communicated with any of these individuals from the end of the retreat, and just so people who are tuning in for the first time know, I want to try an experiment. I've done over 41 clinical trials with humans. These are non-medical. These are lifestyle and behavior modification, meaning healthy diet, cleansing, detoxing, juicing, meditation, yoga, and allowing the energy of our mindset to change from being a victim and being angry at the world and to being one where we feel we're okay. We can control our outcomes, and we can change negative into positive. And I've done these generally in settings where the shortest is a month, the longest a year and a half, on a regular basis, and people keep diaries and so they can tell their progress, and we now video stream them so that we can see what happens on day one and what happens on the last day, and then the comparisons. So by inviting people who had conditions that they were not succeeding in changing, and they had a long time, years, to change them, we wanted to see what would happen if you did nothing medical. Mind you, I don't diagnose or treat anything ever. But instead, you promote the concept of wellness. Wellness of our thoughts, our behavior. And there was no specific protocols. I never do that where we got to take this and this and this. Instead, it was liberating the mind to help the body in its journey. If you can help a person change their perceptions, you indeed help them change their reality. So let's see what that we have. And let's begin by saying hello with, I'm told, Max is up. Max, nice to have you with us today.
Gary, nice to speak to you again.
Tell us your experience, what changed in your life, not what you did, but what changed in your life starting at the retreat, and have you been able to carry that forward over the last month?
So what changed at the retreat is I did more exercise in that 1 month than I had done in 10 years. And I started eating green, completely green. When I came home, I started working at a convalescent center where I have to do a lot of walking across the whole space. So I'm always speed walking there. One of my coworkers and I are getting ready to start a walking group up in Rockland where I live. And, she, along with probably a number of other coworkers at different places, are starting to green and red juice because they always ask me how I lost so much weight. So the green and red juices go everywhere with me. That was another change. Is about more than 90% of my active nutrition is still juicing. It's the only thing that gives me a sense of really of vitality and energy. And so those have been changes that I carried forward. I think re-clarifying for myself what it means to be of service to others and how to nurture myself has been a big thing. And no longer sacrificing myself in unnecessary ways to be of use to others and harming myself inadvertently or intentionally. So continuing to be a being of light and to living in a place of love has been an immense thing for me. I really learned again during my time with you and my time with the group of people that were caring and giving space for us to have that environment, how to, again, simplify my life and detach. So that's really carrying forward. We're about to move from a place that was 3,500 feet to a place that's 500 feet, and that's going to give me an immense amount more time to be a family member, to be present for all the beautiful things that are happening in my family life, and to be present, to be mindful of all these moments.
How much weight have you lost?
I came to you at about 200. When I got home, I was around 173, 174. I'm perching into the 160s now, so I had a little bit of regression in terms of my velocity of weight loss, but I'm maintaining it. And
what do you think is the most important lesson you learned during that month?
That every moment is a new moment. That that the light of God dwells in every human being, and to honor it consistently, to be present for every moment, and to forgive myself, and to forgive everyone else around me, and to be of service to everyone that I can be, and to live in absolute truth always.
Good for you. Did you notice the difference between those who came to really change and really be there for the right reasons versus a couple people who came for the wrong reasons, just bringing their negativity and leaving with their negativity?
Oh, completely. And some of it surprised me because, one of the people that came so miserable, and within 7 to 10 days of really absorbing the environment was completely transformed and was open and vulnerable and transformed, and they got so much out of their experience there because they were willing to let go, and they were willing to be proactive and do for themselves. They were no longer willing to remain a victim. And if anyone came to just basically looking to be served or looking for an environment where they could spend time socializing or talking or God forbid, thinking you were going to change them or you were going to do a single thing for them, they were going to gripe and be miserable and talk about anyone there under the sun rather than just do for themselves and be in a place of authenticity and ownership for who they are. So the change was night and day. If someone came to be present and to do for themselves and to be empowered to be the best that they were to be, they were going to get something out of it. And if you came just to have other people clean up for you and for someone else, get another person to blame for you're not succeeding and you're not transforming, you are going to be unhappy.
Okay. Max, thank you. I never asked Max what he did, but once it slipped out, something that he is working in the medical field, that's all I'll say, and in a hospital helping save lives. Thank you, Max. Let's say hello to Lori. Hi, Lori. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you.
Very good.
So tell us what changed.
Say it again?
Tell us what changed. What you don't have today that you had when you arrived.
Since coming home, I can definitely say with confidence that I am in a lot less pain, chronic pain that I had in my joints than when I came to the retreat on October 1st.
Okay. What else has changed?
Since coming home, I have made it my business to keep up with physical activity. Normally, when the months are cold and I'm here in New York City, like most other people, I tend to stay indoors, you know, and not have a lot of physical movement again until spring allows for us to come out. But since coming home, I've made it my business to join a New York City Parks and Recreation facility to which I can now do pool exercise, which is very helpful. And I've also made sure to keep up with regular exercise, such as on the machines, lifting a little bit of weights and using a little bit of the elliptical to keep my joints moving and to help keep them lubricated through my movement.
How long have you been in pain?
I've been in pain for over 10 years. Over 10 years.
10 years. And you've tried everything that medicine had to offer?
I've been on multiple biologics, multiple pain medications. I've done physical therapy. At one point, a doctor had mentioned to me that I would have to have a knee replacement, and I was in my 20s at the time. And I said, I don't want a knee replacement in my 20s. I'm too young for a knee replacement. And so I've done so many different things, and hearing about what they expected from me was just very disheartening.
And how much reduction on a scale of 1 to 100, how much reduction has there been in sustained of your pain?
Oh, I want to say when I came to the retreat, my pain, if 100 is the worst or highest intensity, I was probably around an 85. And since coming to the retreat and being involved in the different activities and healthy eating and other ways of relieving stress, I want to say it's down to about a 35, and I've been maintaining it that way.
Good for you. And what was your most important lesson that you learned?
I want to say my most important lesson was more mental and emotional, that I needed to love myself more. I realized when I came to the retreat, other than the pain that I had trouble loving myself and, you know, having good thoughts about myself. And when I struggled with that, then it was more difficult to take care of myself and deal with the pain. But once I came there and helped to relieve stress and helped to relieve emotions that I didn't realize I had suppressed, I was able to come into a self-love and a self-awareness that allowed me to take care of myself meaningfully and more consistently.
How many of the lessons and lectures did you hear that were based upon the strongest quality we have in life is self-love?
Pretty much almost every single one. I can't remember a day where you did not mention that we had to love ourselves. And unfortunately, that's the problem that people encounter a lot more than we think. We may think that we love ourselves, but if we loved ourselves, many of the habits, the bad habits that we have, if we truly loved ourselves, we would not engage in.
Good. Well, thank you for being on and continued journey, and we'll speak to you in the near future.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you so much.
Let's say hello to Dieback. Hi, Dieback. Your turn.
How are you?
Good. Tell us about your story, please.
Let me say one thing right now. It's a real pleasure to hear from you live again and to hear from both Max and Laurie. Max was my roommate. I had a wonderful time with him. About what I gained from it, I'm not sure I can describe it all yet because it actually keeps growing. I feel like you planted a bunch of seeds and some of the stuff is still blooming. I have to agree with Laurie that a lot of the stuff, the best stuff was mental and emotional. I feel like I'm a lot more in charge easily and naturally about decisions I want to make. it's not like these decisions are so hard to do. Actually, one of the nice things about the retreat was showing how if you change your attitude and your mind, that a lot of the things just come to you naturally, easily, and spontaneously. In terms of stuff that I gained, you know, physically, quantifiably, I gained, I think, over 15 pounds. I didn't even realize it at the time when I came, but looking back on it, I feel like I probably even had kind of like a wasting disease. When I got there, I was 112 pounds, and being around 5'10", that's not too good. One of the things that you did while I was there was to make sure that I got protein drinks three times a day, and you started fattening me up with wonderful breakfast oatmeal. Some of the things that I feel I gained from were really kind of very subtle. It was like planting in my mind how wonderful it is to eat really great healthy food. Getting up in the morning and having watermelon and pineapple and berries, I mean, it was, if not orgasmic, it was pre-orgasmic. And another thing is that taking care of your health can be a lot of fun. There was a lot of humor on the retreat. In your lectures, I can't count the number of times when you started laughing or would, you know, throw in some really good point, but you made it very humorously. And like I say, I gained 15 pounds of mostly on muscle, not fat at all. The swimming pool was absolutely wonderful with the mineral water.
How are your lungs now? What's the status there?
Oh, my lungs are pretty good. I don't cough. I don't sneeze. You know, I'm not short of breath. Going out walking, I still have a lot of trouble walking, but I don't think there was anything you could do about that. You and Elaine, the massage therapist, both gave me some good advice. Turned out I had broken a leg, and that shortened one leg over the other. So I have some structural problems, but I have made an appointment with the orthopedist to see about that. And I have a very hopeful feeling that once I can work on some of that, I'll be doing a lot more walking so that my lungs will be in even better shape because there's no substitute for exercise. But like I say, I'm not sure exactly how much I gained because I keep discovering every day or at least every week or every month some new thing that I've gained.
Good for you.
I think I gained things that I couldn't quantify exactly. They tend to grow.
That's called the gestalt.
And I'm sorry, sir?
It's called the gestalt. It means we have a solution before we knew we had a problem, an answer before we knew we had a question. That's the planting those seeds to come in. All right, good. Yeah. Well, I thank you. We got
Say something else, too. I had a greater appreciation of people. The people who I was on that retreat with, I will never forget them. And they were all really wonderful people. Not all, but the people that I was with, all the people that were there for 1 month, was I think of the wonderful older couple and down to the people who were very young, like Mary Ann, who's only 20. And
Do you remember the older couple, he 93, and they've been married, I believe, 47 years. And when he got there, he had that Alzheimer's stare where he just stared vacuously into the sky and had no energy, was bent over, wouldn't talk, had no memory. But at the end, he was joking. He would answer questions articulately, and specifically his short-term memory had returned. He was standing upright. He had vitality. He was able to walk. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the last week of the thing, he came over to me. I was sitting outside in the sunshine, and he walked up to me, and he asked me if I wanted to sing a duet with him. He asked me if I knew a song called Go to Sleep, Lonely Hobo. And fortunately, I knew the song. The two of us harmonized on this wonderful song, and he came over all by himself and asked me to sing with him. So I will never forget that.
Do you remember when we were all sitting around and I would ask questions and he would be the one answering it before anyone else? This is an advanced Alzheimer's dementia case, and you don't see that. And his wife at the end came over and says, thank you, I got my husband back.
Yeah, and he was making jokes, too.
Yeah. Well,
I was nice walking by, and like I say, I don't walk that good because one leg's shorter than the other. And he said to me, where are you going, speed demon?
Well, he has many more years ahead, and he'll have a clear mind now. Thanks
I
a
hope
lot.
So. Okay,
nice
thank you,
you,
Gary. Won't forget you.
And we only have time for one more, so let's say hello to Marianne. Hi, Mariana.
Hi, Gary.
Please tell us your story.
So when I first came to the retreat, you know, I was struggling with severe multiple sclerosis. And we were able to get me back to being able to balance on one foot for 42 seconds. Since then, I can stand on one foot and I can balance for about a minute and a half now. I speed walk everywhere I go when I'm at work, so I make sure to get that exercise in. And if I don't, I have a treadmill at my house that I like to work out on as well, since it's cold where I live. My perspective on everything has completely changed. I no longer look at such life as a pessimistic point of view. Before, I was very depressed and very negative, and I've now learned to understand that other people's attitudes and their behaviors shouldn't affect me as hard and as personal as I do take them. I've learned to put myself first. That is one of the most important things I have learned, is putting my health and myself first. I used to always want to make all my other family members happy or my friends happy before I could allow myself to be happy. But I am using my voice more often now, and I am telling people what I need and what I want, and I'm making sure that those are being completed and that I am always putting my health above all. Recently for Thanksgiving, we had an all-vegan Thanksgiving. My mother was a huge help helping me cook with all those recipes and making sure that I can still enjoy the holiday with my family at the same time, as well as putting my health and having that there for me as well.
Now, when you first arrive with advanced multiple sclerosis, one of the symptoms is people cannot walk straight. They can't put one foot in front of the other foot in front of the other. They'll fall over. That was the case with you too, correct?
Yes, my left leg would swing over my right one, I'd trip, and I'd fall.
And that had been going on for some time.
For the past
and what happened
3 years.
By the end of the retreat?
By the end of the retreat, I can walk perfectly straight. I can even walk in a single file line perfectly straight.
And how's your energy today?
My energy is at an all-time high. I wake up every morning grateful for everything that I have. I always start the day off on a positive note. I rarely feel tired, and I make sure to get a full night's rest of sleep. And even if I don't get a full 8 hours, I still feel the same amount of energy that I would if I did.
And what was your most important takeaway message?
The most important was to always put myself first, to allow myself to have what I deserve to have, what I should have. I learned to love myself, my authentic self, more than what my conditioned self was. So my conditioned self was always putting my self-esteem down, and because of that, I was always sad and I was never happy. I'm learning to love myself, my authentic self, more, and allowing myself to get what I want and what I deserve and make those changes. And if something isn't settling me right, I will speak up about it and I will say something, where before I would crawl into a shell and I'll just stay quiet and be shy. But I am more courageous now.
And no longer depressed?
No longer depressed at all.
Good. How long had you been depressed?
I'm sorry?
How long had you suffered from depression?
I'd say since I was diagnosed 3 years ago.
3 years, and you're no longer depressed now?
No.
So, how about that? No longer depressed after 3 years of deep depression, no longer limited in how you walk and exercise and putting yourself first and being affirmative and not allowing yourself to be used or abused. And remember, the takeaway word was for everyone at every lecture, if someone can't treat you with dignity and respect and love, then don't deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't deserve to be in your life. All the best to you, Mariana.
Thank you so much.
We're out of time, but there you have at least some. I'm sorry I couldn't get more than, we had a total of 9 people who spent the month, but 5 of them were on, and on some future date we'll have them, others on, but they're not only improving, but substantially improving and major changes. So it's just to show you that it's not about miracles. It's about believing that you have in you what you need to become a healthier and happier human being. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.